So, Bill, how did you come to Malden?
Well, it was in the early 1980s, and I had had a business and lived in Epping. Sadly, during that recession, the business went bust, and I was working from home as a freelance designer, artist and designer, which was my occupation. And I was headhunted by a company that I had been doing a little bit of work for in Epping, and they were based in Heybridge, and that was industrial control services. And I did a speculative design for them because I was really looking for a bit of new business, and met the chairman, and he offered me a job. So I was appointed as the marketing director for his business, and that was originally in the sales department, which was based in Epping, but subsequently moved as the company expanded very quickly, because at that time they were very busy and growing very quickly. The Epping office was closed down and moved to Heybridge, to the factory.
And what sort of age were you then, Bill?
Oh, 51, 2.
Right.
Yeah. I was asked to move down to Malden because I think the certainly the chairman, Peter, was concerned about me driving in the M25 rat race twice a day. And since the company were paying for the move, I decided to do that. Needless to say, my late wife wasn't very pleased because we had been established in Epping for many years, since the 1960s, and the children had grown up there, etc., etc. But it was necessary to make the move, and after a very short period, my wife recovered from her concerns and fell in love with Malden, as people do.
Lovely.
And as I did. So that's how I got here.
Mm-hmm.
And the looking back on the coronation, it's a long while ago, sure, 75 years, we all know that. There's an awful lot of statistical information available on the web, which of course in those days didn't exist. I don't think it's necessary to bombard everybody with loads of statistics unless they are strictly relevant to the event and to what was happening to me. So, let's just put the coronation in its place in British history. And I think everybody knows that the practice is to measure the passage of time by the monarchs. And if we go back to Queen Victoria, we refer to that period as the Victorians, and then when she died, King Edward, her eldest son, became king, and he died before the beginning of the First World War, and his son, George, became George V. And it was George V that changed the name of the family to the Windsors. So from, I suppose, just pre-First World War, the name of our sovereigns was Windsor. So George V was followed by his son, George VI. And then when George VI died, Elizabeth, his eldest daughter, became queen. A complete sort of run of succession. And the ceremony, the coronation, took place in 1953, whereas she became queen a year previously in February 1952, when her father died. So that's, that puts it into some kind of historical context. And I suppose the next question is really, how did I get involved in such lofty matters? Well, the answer is that I was in the army. When I left school, I became an apprentice in a London art studio to Mr. Edwards in Fetter Lane. And that apprenticeship was for 5 years in the City of London. And in 1949, it was decided to introduce national service. And all males who were physically fit had to do national service from the age of 18. And the exception to that was when you registered for national service around the 18th year, your 18th year, if you were an undergraduate or an indentured apprentice, you were deferred joining up until you had completed your studies or your trade training. And I was eligible for that deferment. So, anyway, the apprenticeship ended on the 1st of February, 1952. And duly reported to barracks at Aldershot on the 7th of February 1952. So that was all fine. Following basic training and army trade training, which in my case was map making. On the move in areas which had been cleared of mines, I was posted to the training battalion's drawing office. And in the army, promotion is pretty quick, because once I'd finished my trade training, which was a couple of months, I was made a lance corporal, and when I was posted to the drawing office, I became a full corporal, which was fine. Anyway, I settled into doing that job, running that department, making training aids and doing anything else that needed graphics. And of course, it's worth pointing out that in those days, there wasn't the kind of electronic and digital facilities that there are now. Everything had to be done by hand. And so that's why being a fully trained commercial artist, I did much the same thing in the army. Fine. One morning, I noticed on the daily orders that they were looking for volunteers for the forthcoming coronation. And I put my name forward because I thought, well, that sounds quite interesting, and it'll be a change from an office job. And so I was duly accepted and posted to another battalion for further training, or for training for the event. And it was a long period of preparation, really. When you think about the enormous size of the undertaking nationally, it's really quite staggering. But I was put in the section of the contingents that would march in the procession. And that involved being really very physically fit. I mean, if you're in the army, you're obviously physically fit anyway. But the object of the training, the preparation, was long marches, and when we weren't doing that, we were doing perhaps two sessions a day in the gymnasium, and the marches became longer and longer. And there was also drill on the parade ground, and all of this was on double rations, which was fine. It was designed to build fitness to really, I suppose, athletic standards, and stamina and endurance. And you'll understand that that was very necessary, because what we did on the day was to march for 22 miles. There was a break about halfway through for food and water and so on and so forth, but the coronation procession was huge. I think there were 26,000 British and Commonwealth troops in the procession. And it took, I'll come to that.
Okay.
But anyway, going back to the preparation for the event, we were issued with British Army number one dress uniforms, which were dark blue. In our case, with white piping, peak caps instead of berets, and the outfit, the clothes were tailored to fit each individual perfectly, so that everybody looked very smart. that was it. So I think the size of the marching contingents was about company strength or slightly smaller, and company strength would be three platoons of 30 men, so around about 90 to 100 people. So comes the 2nd of June, we were taken by train to London, to Earth Court. And Earth Court Exhibition Centre in West London. And the centre was commandeered and converted into barracks. It was a barrack for 6,000 soldiers, with the main exhibition space on the ground floor, a huge dining hall, and the rest of the building was filled with wooden bunks and sectioned off as billets. I say billets because billets is the correct word for somewhere where soldiers stay in commandeered accommodation. Anyway, when we arrived at our billet, the regimental sergeant major gathered everyone together and really gave a few words of warning, shall we say. And he was very much a Londoner, and I won't attempt to imitate how he spoke, or for that matter, what he said. But his concern was to explain that there were a variety of troops visiting from foreign parts, like Canada, Australia, so on and so forth, because in those days we still were very much at the end of the days of empire, but the Commonwealth was still very, very close, I suppose. Because it wasn't so long after the end of the war, so you know all of the effort and so on and so forth was well remembered, shall we say. Anyway, his message was that all these guys would be looking for trophies or mementos, and so we were to be very careful about guarding our kit, and if anybody reported missing something, they were going to be in a great deal of trouble with the said RSM, because you know, we had to be 100% there.
RSM is Regimental Sergeant Major?
Yes, RSM is Regimental Sergeant Major, that's correct. I think our contingent had two of them. Obviously, one more senior to the other. The other thing that was an interesting constituent was that there were every unit in the army was represented, and the corps that I belonged to was a very large one, the Royal Army Service Corps, and constituted roughly a fifth or 20% of the army. But in this call for volunteers, there were people sent from Hong Kong, from Malaya, from various parts of the world, from the British Army of the Rhine, and from various parts of Great Britain and various other parts of the Commonwealth, where there were British soldiers. So we were a very, very mixed bunch. And it was a mixture of regular soldiers and national servicemen. But of course, all army training is the same, whatever your status is. So we took to heart the fact that our neighbours were not to be trusted, and were very careful about making darn sure that they didn't pinch anything. So there we were. We were then dismissed and stood down and went off to the dining hall for an evening meal and so to bed. The coronation day. Reveille. Ablutions. Bedding had to be folded and so that the billet area was tidy, and then dressing and breakfast. Then back to the billet area to await the call to fall in. And so that duly arrived. I don't remember what time it was, but the 6,000 soldiers in Earl's Court fell in and then left the building in the order that they were in the forthcoming procession. And when we left the building, we were behind our military band. Behind us was another marching contingent, and they were followed by another military band, who were then followed by another contingent. So there were bands spread through the procession. And this is the figure I was trying to think of earlier. The whole procession, once it was on the road, was approximately 2 miles long. Wow. And it took 29,000 servicemen and women were in the procession, and the parade took 3/4 of an hour to pass any given point. So it was a huge, huge undertaking, marching and mounted mixture. So there were the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, for example, and I think there were various contingents from different Commonwealth countries that were also mounted or marching or both. So a real mix. And there is, of course, plenty of newsreel of these people, but generally the newsreel clips are very short, you know, and I guess that if you were particularly interested, you would be able to research longer pieces of film from that time in the various military museums that various regiments and military organisations have. So it was all filmed. Anyway, the big surprise for me, I suppose, were two things, really. One was the kind of atmosphere. That's yes, it was an atmosphere, I'm sure, because there had been a long build-up to the coronation, and at the end of the 1940s decade, the war had been over for 4 years, and the new decade, the 1950s, heralded a sort of, era of hope, promise, maybe. And I say that and then think to myself, well, I was 21 years of age. Of course, I thought about life in those terms of being full of hope and promise. Why wouldn't you? looking back on those times, I believe the feeling of optimism and opportunity had really been growing as the new decade opened in the 50s. And as I say, perhaps it was me growing into manhood. And in those days, of course, we didn't have teenagers as a separate group. You were a youngster and you became a man, you know. And certainly I had been doing well in my training at work. And I had already met my future wife. So, I had everything to look forward to. And I hope, and I'm sure an awful lot of other people felt the same. And certainly my nature is to be happy and positive anyway. And I had... I had grown up with rationing shortages. The restrictions and the bomb damage, because I was 8 years of age when the war started and 15 when it finished. So those formative years were all characterised by the events going on in the wider world. But I had been fired up, by the Festival of Britain, which took place in 1951. And that, I think, was, again, something that everybody enjoyed and was excited about and held out the promise of a much better future for the country as we sort of struggled to rebuild. Because still in the 1950s, there was a great deal of bomb damage in London and in the big cities and so on and so forth. Difficult to imagine now, but there were these great gaps full of weeds and rubble. Oh dear. So on that dull and drizzly morning in West London, what I didn't expect was the volume of noise, clapping, shouting, cheering, screaming. It was non-stop from the time we got onto the roads all day. And, of course, there were huge crowds lining the route every inch. And, of course, the effect of that was that you simply could not hear the band or any of the commands as we marched. And the march was at, for want of a better word, at attention. So you had your rifle and bayonet on your shoulder, and every I don't know how long, I suppose every now and again the order was given to change arms. So from that side you changed over to this side to give your shoulder a rest. And at that time an army rifle I think weighed about enough for you to notice that you were carrying it. I can't remember how much it was in pounds, and I certainly couldn't convert that to metric. But that's that's another matter. Anyway, so marching along, I could see the cap of the RSM at the front of the contingent, because I was at the back. I could see his head go up because he was shouting, and I think everybody else in the contingent cottoned on to that, and so we rather raggedly changed arms. Oh dear. Anyway, one of the nice perks about being in the parade was that I was given tickets for Mum and Dad to watch, and the tickets were set for seats in the Mall. And my mother decided not to take up the offer, but my father took advantage of it, and afterwards he was able to boast that he'd seen Queen Victoria and all these successive monarchs up to and including Elizabeth in his own lifetime. So that was very good. He was very pleased about that. Also, my girlfriend and her pal watched it, and they had gone up to London the night before, as had a lot of young people, and slept on the pavement. So they would be well placed to get a good view the next day. And I can't remember whether she actually saw me. I don't think she did, because I think I was on the left-hand side of the contingent, and I think they had found a spot which would have been on the right, and there were, and that, you know, it would have been very difficult to pick out somebody. Oh dear.
You said it was drizzly. Had they slept on the pavement?
Oh yes, I think. Yeah. Well, I don't know whether it rained during the night, but I really can't remember the details. The atmosphere, of course, in the crowds was you know, wonderful, really. And all our training got us through the 22 miles we marched that day, with a welcome break, as I said earlier, for food and drink. And that break was we were halted in Birdcage Walk, which is to the right of the palace and runs up to from where the palace is to towards Hyde Park Corner, and that way, that one. During the march, it was, because of the training, it was so sort of embedded that you could sort of switch off, and I think you moved sort of automatically. And I remember having to make my mind concentrate on what I was doing as I was marching along several times. The march was, as I said earlier, at attention at all times. And so you couldn't speak to the man next to you, and you looked straight ahead. And I was almost sort of kind of drifted into a trance, really, and I found myself wandering. I don't know, mind wandering. As I say, I had to really concentrate. And I don't know whether that was the same for other people. I don't think in those days, I guess you didn't talk to people about your feelings as people do nowadays. You know, I mean, you can imagine nowadays on social media would be swamped with people's feelings of pleasure or anxiety or this or that. But in those days, you were expected to keep your feelings to yourself, and you did. Because if you started certainly if you were in the army, you were abused by your mates as being some kind of oddity. I remember, the fact that you were marching along and really you were completely on your own because there was no communication. And I was 6 feet tall, and so I was on almost the last file because the contingent is arranged so that the tallest men are at either end and the shortest in the middle, sort of thing. And behind me was the other RSM, so it was necessary to be to certainly pay attention and behave, because you would have been in his line of sight. So alone in your little world, you marched along with people shouting at you. Weird. I wasn't dreaming. It was really happening. And the procession took us past all the familiar landmarks in London: the Palace, the Abbey, the Palace of Westminster, the famous roads, Whitehall and the like, and the parks, of course. And everywhere were the crowds of spectators and the noise. And I do remember, as we marched along the Mall and the Palace came into view, and the thought went through my mind and obviously stayed, that on that day, at that moment, I think I said to myself, I will remember this moment, and with pride, and being here. And so I have remembered over the last 75 years.
Brilliant, brilliant. Did you stay in your billet the same night, or were you all dispersed at that point?
When we were dismissed, I think I got changed back into battle dress in the billet, and we had something to eat. And then I realised that I could get on the underground and go straight to where my girlfriend lived in Buckhurst Hill, which I did. And she was very keen that we should go get back on the underground and go back up to London and enjoy the festivities that were going on there. But I was ashamed to say that I was too tired. I just couldn't face any more physical exertion. And I think she was very disappointed. And I felt sorry about that, but, you know, it was one of those things, really. Yeah. You know.
And had there been much chatter amongst the soldiers the previous day, or did you keep yourselves to yourselves as you've described at other times?
Yeah, well, I suppose, I can't remember really. I mean, I had, when I got back, I mean, we were taken back the next day, virtually, to our various units, or everybody dispersed. And I remember talking to my pals in the barracks about it, but I think sort of just got on with life, really.
Right. Bill, you're just showing me a medal with a red and blue ribbon and a white edge and a gold actual metal coin, as it were. Can you tell me what that is?
That's the coronation medal.
And did everyone get that, one who served on the parade?
Well, I think everybody was eligible. Whether or not everybody got one, I don't know. But I got one.
And was that on the day? Or?
Oh, no. I think it arrived and was issued, really.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's a "you were there" medal, not a medal that was of any particular significance, shall we say. It was just a service medal. Right. And I've always been a bit shy about it because my father was awarded a medal for gallantry in 1918. And when he was blinded by mustard gas, and he eventually recovered his sight and was a successful, was successful in life. And my two elder brothers were both in the... One was in the Royal Navy, and the other one was in the Army. And father and my two brothers, between them, had 27 medals. And the one that was in the Navy had a medal for every theatre of war from 1939 to 90. You know. So the fact that I got that, I sort of... I would have got teased unmercifully.
Well, thank you. So, would you like to say something more about your reason for coming to Maldon and the industry that you were associated with?
Yes, when I was offered a job with a company that was based in Maldon, Heybridge, Industrial Control Services, and moved down to Maldon from Epping, my wife was pretty appalled at the prospect, but she very quickly, once we had moved, she very quickly fell in love with Maldon, and so that was fine. But the experience was very interesting because I had worked in the advertising industry all my life, including having my own design studio Becoming a marketing manager with a large and growing company was a different experience, sure. But after having my own business and spending, I think I had, that was for 12 years, and I think I spent 24 years chasing money. Having a job, famously, my daughter, youngest daughter, when I got the letter appointing me as marketing manager, said, "Dad's got a proper job." So I came down here, and I was at a good management level in a company that was manufacturing, well, industrial control services, designed, manufactured, installed, and serviced instrumentation, which was used to operate continuous processes such as North Sea oil recovery or natural gas recovery or water purification, waterworks, and activities which were going on 24 hours a day or forever and still do. And so the interesting aspects of working in that industry was certainly for me, it was a steep learning curve to learn the technology, but I didn't have to learn it as an engineer. I had to learn it as a marketing man, which was concerned with the market for the end product. In advertising, if you work in the advertising industry in those days, certainly, that was part of your activity. So that was fine. And, of course, after my previous experience with my own business, working for somebody else was a holiday, because they were extremely good employers. They were very, I suppose, old-fashioned. They cared about people. They looked after us very well. There was a wonderful sort of family spirit and attitude which drove the company forward. And it was expanding at a great rate because there was huge demand for the product in the North Sea. And there was also the beginnings of microprocessor technology taking over from solid-state technology. And that was very interesting. And of course, our product development people were busy working on how to do that. So we were developing new things, new ideas, new thinking, and a lot of our engineers were graduates who didn't want to go into the defence industries, but were very happy to go into an industry which, like ours, which was contributing to the well-being and benefit of mankind. So that was an area of sort of responsibility, which, of course, is mostly invisible, and still is invisible. But there were some interesting aspects of the thing, in the sense that the building that we eventually took over had been Bentall's building, where they had stored agricultural machinery. And I certainly, in my mind, drew a parallel between the fact that William Bentall invented the gold hanger plough, and the effect of that was to revolutionise farming and farm production or food production in the 1800s. And that business had grown and grown and grown and grown until it was an enormous undertaking up until the 1950s, when other people had finally caught up. And, like so much of British industry, it began to fade. But in the same building, we had engineers who were developing ideas and techniques which were groundbreaking and completely new.
Can you give an example?
Yes, and of course there were, in Malden at that time, there was a lot of very groundbreaking industry. I think just up the road there was somebody in optics who was who'd come up with ways of doing things which were had never been done before, etc., etc. And of course, part of marketing is publicising things. And fortunately, instrumentation or the engineering trade press weren't particularly interested in what we were doing. And certainly the local papers were definitely not interested. So if we got a contract which was very big and very good news for Malden, the Malden Burnham Standard would be very reluctant to say anything about it. If, on the other hand, somebody was made redundant, there'd be headlines. And of course, over the years, I developed an intense dislike of journalists and their obsession with presenting bad news. And I wonder whether they ever consider the fact that that really just sort of depresses people and turns them off. Because, certainly those long years of growth and employment and success and profit were wonderful. But again, the company grew to the point where it was decided to go to the stock exchange and become a public company. And sadly, that experience took away the top management's focus on what they were doing in terms of the marketplace and the product, because the city demanded profit and profit forecasts and every 6 months. And of course, I think it took 4 or 5 years for us to develop a new product. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think it was a disaster to go to the city, because their concern is money and profit, and unless you're a gigantic engineering company, you should stay away from them. Engineers can do arithmetic and don't need all that rubbish, I think, to service other people's dividends.
So did the company fold in the end?
Yes, it did, because the bank were concerned about a gap in the financial arrangements, and I think to be as polite as possible, put the boot in. And they didn't actually go bust, but they sold to a venture capital company. And they're still going, but of course they're now purchased by an American company who were, I think their principal interest was to get ownership of the patent of a piece of kit which is used in the launch program of American or the International Space Activity. And America has this view that they want to buy American. And we had a company in America, and we sold that particular product through that company because it was American and registered in America. But they didn't actually own the intellectual property. But by buying the whole shooting match, they did then acquire the intellectual property. So that's how all of that happened. And of course it was a great shame that, you know, eventually at the top it employed about over 350 people in Malden and in other parts of the world. There were companies and so on and so forth, and all of that disappeared, really.